Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Unauthorized Disclosure Podcast. I'm Kevin Gastola, and I'm joined by my co-host, Rania Kalik. Hey, Rania.
Hey, Kevin.
And it's really good to be back, and we're pleased to have as our guest this week, Matt Taibbi. He's the host of the recently released book, Hate Inc., Why Today's Media Makes Us Despise One Another. He's also a Rolling Stone reporter and a co-host of the Useful Idiots podcast with a friend of the show, Katie Halper. So welcome to the show, Matt.
Thanks a lot, Kevin. How are you doing, Rania?
I'm good. Thanks so much for coming on. We've been really excited to have you on for quite some time. So it's perfect timing.
Yeah.
It's really great. And I think the one thing that we should probably start with, which is just a natural way to start any conversation, especially when you're a first-time guest, is as I go through your book, there's a lot of your own reporting experience that runs throughout this book. So, you know, you're able to write what we could call a polemic, even though a lot of people in our culture use that negatively. But in a positive sense, you're able to write these words with authority because you have this experience. So could you share a little bit about, you know, how you come around to writing this book and what motivated you to put this together?
Sure. I've been, one of the things I start by saying is that I've been around the media my whole life. My father was a television reporter in a local affiliate in Boston. So my childhood was a lot like the movie Anchorman, you know, with the bad facial hair and the giant mics and all that. And so I grew up around that. I had a lot of, you know, experience as a young person sort of watching the changes in the journalism business in my father's newsrooms. I went into the business myself overseas when I was about 20, 21, and started working in the former Soviet Union. I was there for about 11, 12 years or so, and came back and worked for Rolling Stone starting in the early 2000s. But I think the thing is I've worked in almost every form of print media. I've done sports writing, I've done investigative reporting, I've done, you know, daily commentary, and I've done the kind of stuff that most of us do now, which is the kind of clickbaity opinion pieces. And what I was trying to point out in the book was just how dramatic the changes in the commercial structure of the business have been in the last 20 years or so, where we're now, almost everybody who works in news media, especially for a living, we're much more engaged in like chasing audience using political slant than we ever were before. And that used to only really be true, or mostly be true, on the Fox side, but it's become a thing on the other side too. And that's what I'm trying to point out in this, is that the news business has changed dramatically in terms of going from something where we're trying to report the news to the whole audience, whereas now we're splitting the audience up into demographics and just giving them news that they want to hear. And that's really what Hate Inc. is about.
So polarizing.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's one of the reasons why people watch the news more than ever now. I mean, if you look at the statistics about it, they're consuming more TV and print media than they ever have before. But every survey says they trust us less than ever before, which means that they're consuming us as entertainment rather than as news. But the entertainment is mostly about getting people to not like each other. So that's what's so such a bummer about the modern news business, is that people read it a lot, but they don't feel good about it afterwards.
And one point you make is that it's about delivering superiority, and, you know, beyond getting into some of the politics that have unfolded in the last couple of years, you say in general that we're selling an identity to people. And I think it'd be important to have you talk to that point, because it's so clear that each of these networks and even these publications are really feeding this sort of brand to people and trying to get them to behave in certain ways.
Sure. And this is something I think people in the entertainment wing of the business understand better than people in the news business do. If you look at, for instance, reality shows, the formula is pretty consistent. What they're putting on television are people who are degrading themselves and debasing themselves and acting like idiots And that's the appeal of the show. You're it's essentially like a freak tent. You're getting people to go in and gawk at the bearded lady and then come out and you feel happy because you're the normal one, right? That's the appeal. But we do that with news too. You know, we're often showing you somebody that you look down on. And the classic example is like in crime reporting where we'll put pictures of some poor sucker who gets arrested for something and looks terrible in a mugshot and has just been indicted for some really stupid crime. And that's, you know, we want the audience to feel superior to the people that we're reporting on. And that's an easy, easy way to get them to come back because they get addicted to that feeling of superiority. And that's kind of what the political reporting is about too. You know, we're showing you somebody who, you know, you think has bad judgment or bad politics, and you get to gape at them and feel better about yourself.
Yeah, now that, you know, when you think about it like that, it's like watching someone like Rachel Maddow. You're like doing it through her lens because she's just like gawking at everybody for you. She's like, ew, look at this person, but like in a serious way. That's pretty much what Rachel Maddow is, just like a serious valley girl. She's like, ew, gross, but like in a more intellectual way.
That would be a great title for an MSNBC show. Even look at this person.
Ew, gross. And just like a photo of Trump and like Putin.
And ew, now, gross. Ew, look at this person with Rich Maddow and Lawrence Alfonso. No.
Exactly. But it is like, it really is like a reality TV show in the purest sense, but I guess, like, I don't get it because I can't, and maybe it's just because of my politics and I'm just really ideological, but, like, I can't watch cable news. Like, it just watching it drives me crazy. It's awful. It's, like, I don't find it entertaining at all, especially when they start talking about the Russia stuff, like, or, like, any Ukraine gate, Russia gate, like, my eyes glaze over because it's, like, there's all these names I can't keep up with and, like, they're like talking about something really dramatic, but I don't really understand it. So I can't even imagine like somebody who doesn't pay attention to politics every day watching their hour of nightly news and finding that entertaining.
Yeah, it's incredibly grating to watch cable news now. I mean, I'm with you. I can't watch it at all. I get like a couple minutes into any broadcast now and I have to turn it off. And I think part of that for me is from having being in the business for so long, the relentless political messaging is just so hard to take. And what you're describing about the exhausting nature of these stories, that's a pretty clear propaganda tactic. I mean, they did it a lot with the WMD episode where every day there was a new development in what happened with the inspections and, oh, the inspectors are in this place and they found this. And you remember this diplomat in Britain just said this. And what happens is, audiences, they lose the thread, and all they really get after a while is the emotional message, which is we have to go in and invade, or you know, the Iraqis are so dangerous, and or in this case with Ukraine gate, you know, Trump is so bad, and you know, everything is, you know, we have to immediately, you know, rescue the presidency from this person. But you tire out the viewer by just bombarding them with details that aren't really relevant to their own lives. And that's a way to break down their defenses.
Yeah, one of the things that is pretty clear here, so a lot of times on this show we talk about Syria, and if you were watching the news right now, there's no way, and I think, Ron, you would agree, there's no way you would have any idea what's going on, even as the news media actually claims to be covering the recent chaos in Syria, the recent like developments with Syria. So I'm just plucking that example out of what's been going on.
Those people don't know what they're talking about most of the time. Like, I imagine the things that like you know really well, Matt, like you probably watch, like you spent a lot of time in Russia, so you probably watch coverage of it. Like, these people are idiots and literally don't know what they're saying. Like, the people presenting the news have no clue what they're talking about. And like, that's how I feel about Syria. It's like, you guys are all idiots. Like, They call like a whole area of Syria the Kurds. Like, it's one group of people that are all exactly the same. There's like one Kurdish political party and that's it. Like, the Kurds. Like, what does that mean? Iraqi Kurds, Syrian Kurds, Turkish Kurds? Like, is the PKK all Kurds now? It's like, I know, but it's really like that's another thing too. It's like watching the news makes you dumber.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And And, you know, people see through that. The business is about, none of us who work in journalism really know anything. I mean, we're like professional test crammers. We give us a topic and, you know, we're supposed to go on television and act like we know what we're talking about within 5 minutes. And of course we don't. And, you know, I think this really came out. There was a famous moment when they had Wolf Blitzer on Jeopardy. And he got like negative $7,000. I forget what it was. He couldn't get any answers right. And it was abundantly clear that this person, you know, removed from CNN scripts, literally knew nothing at all about anything. And you know, there's a huge taboo. I actually write about this in the book, that one of the biggest taboos in the business is to say, I don't know. Right. Like if you're on the air and somebody asks you a question, and I actually had this happen to me once in a CNN panel show. I thought it was going on about another topic, and they asked me about something about Israel and Palestine. And I don't cover that subject. So I said, yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's not my area of expertise. And of course, I never got invited on that show again. But, you know, that idea that we're authorities about everything and what we're telling you is the truth and we're informed, you know, that's a big lie too, right? And I think audiences do pick up on that, you know, even if they don't realize it, the idea that all these people are experts in what they're talking about is just absurd. You couldn't be, you know?
No, it's impossible. Right? It's impossible. And, like, I actually really, like, there's like this whole new thing now where it's, I don't know if this existed during the lead up to the Iraq War. I was like still in high school. I wasn't paying that much attention. But at least now with respect to like, whether it's the Middle East or whether you're like whether it's China or Russia, there's like this whole crop of, you know, so-called experts that work at think tanks that are like funded by the military industry, and like funded by like NATO and the US State Department. And like, I don't know, did that exist during Iraq, WMDs, where they're like experts on TV, you know, being the experts and telling you like they know what's going on?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the think tank, actually, it's not a think tank. It's you know, a watchdog organization, the Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Throughout that entire era of the Iraq War, what the cable networks were doing was they were just hiring loads and loads and loads of people who were either recently retired military officials or intelligence officials. This is happening again now. But back then it was unbelievable. They had like, you know, dozens apiece. And, you know, it adds this air of gravitas to the broadcast, but of course you're only seeing things through one lens, right? Where the military experts, all they care about is what's going to work, what the military strategy is, what the capability of the Iraqis was, whereas the real question we should have been asking is, should we even be doing this? You know, there are no experts. They weren't hiring experts in that, you know. So the think tanks have always been there. They've always been funded by big companies and/or you know, interests aligned with the military, weapons manufacturers. And that's a great way to kind of shade the news in a certain direction, because, you know, the when you want to quote somebody, they're always there. They're always willing to pick up the phone and say something about something. And that's how you present. You get like something that looks like news, but it's actually more like propaganda.
And then, like, you talk in the book about like pressures that journalists face, and like you faced them before. Like, is there like a social ostracism? Why can I say this word? You don't want to be socially ostracized.
Exactly. Like, yeah.
Right. Like, so if you're covering something like you've covered Iraq War, if you're covering something like that, like, does the sort of like social atmosphere around the issue like shape how you cover it? And like, has that been your experience with other journalists too?
For sure. And you know, I'm going through that a little bit now because I'm kind of counter-narrative on the Ukraine thing. But the way – this is funny. You know, the book that I read when I was a young person, Manufacture and Consent by Noam Chomsky and Ed Herman, which is a famous book of media criticism, and one of their key principles was that censorship doesn't happen at the point of content. It happens at the point of hire. So if you're the kind of person who's going to make trouble, that you just don't get promoted, you don't get on the front page to begin with. And if you're the kind of person who goes against the grain, you get a reputation for being a quote-unquote difficult person or a, you know, a difficult personality, and you just won't rise in this business. And, you know, you see people like Chris Hedges, for instance, like those people always wash out in this business, and you don't want to be that person. And that's how it affects the way you cover everything, because, you know, you don't want to be the kid with lice in the classroom. And it's especially bad in the social media era, because your colleagues all see the reaction instantaneously, and that's not a place anyone wants to be.
Well, I think
Do you feel like Matt feel like he has lice?
Yeah, I think all of us in this podcast.
We all have lice.
Yeah, all have lice. No, I think like a particular like clear example was from the past week with a CNN contributor, Bakari Sellers, actually just saying, even as his CNN fellow colleagues blanched, that Tulsi Gabbard was a Putin asset or a puppet of the Russian government, with no evidence whatsoever. And for anyone to come out and defend her would be totally like encouraging everyone to just pile on you and just pummel you into oblivion. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, yeah, you can't. Tulsi Gabbard is like one of the top 10 topics that you just don't want to go anywhere near if you want to have a placid social media experience. Yes, I think a lot of news reporters, even the ones who don't particularly like Tulsi Gabbard, they don't like the idea of going on their station or their newspaper or whatever it is and saying something as indefensible as this person is a puppet of a foreign regime, right? That's a classic example of something we can't say because we can't report it. And yet, where were the people who would stand up and say, hey, there's no place for that in our network? They're not going to do that because they don't want all those Tulsi, anti-Tulsi people on social media branding them as a Tulsi stan or whatever it is. Yeah. You know, you all know this. You barely talked about Tulsi, and you get that. So, yeah.
Well, and then in general,
you actually interviewed her. Did she like breathe fire?
No, there were no scales, nothing like that. No.
She's not a lizard person.
No, she's human. Yeah, yeah.
Was that like gray strand of hair, like secretly taping you? But I mean, like in general, if someone is labeled a pariah by this media that you're documenting in your book, there's really nothing you can do to change the script.
No, and there's also no place to hide anymore. And this is one of the things that I thought was interesting about when they fired the New York Times public editor Liz Spade a few years ago. She one of the things that she wrote about in late 2016 is she was criticizing some New York Times reporters for having opinions about the election on social media. And one of the things she was saying was that in the old days, reporters didn't have to do that. You know, they weren't on social media, so they didn't have to be editorialists all the time. And there was a long period in our history where you could be a reporter and people just would have no idea what your political views were. And that was a safe haven for people in this business. Like you could just go out and do the job and not worry about that. But now you can't do that. Now everyone knows what you think, you know, whether you're a cat person or a dog person. I mean, so you can't just hide behind the old objectivity thing anymore, which I think is bad because it makes it impossible to do the job without having some kind of political label on you, which is not good. You know, I think you want people to be able to just report and not identify, you know, which is not possible anymore.
Yeah, that's fair.
One thing that I've heard, listening to you on Useful Idiots, you've mentioned Joe Rogan a couple times, and it's totally taboo for anybody to mention his show if you're a liberal these days. But there's something that I've heard him say multiple times, and I'm wondering if you've heard it too. And I'm just thinking, as the business is so degraded, it's something that anybody who's a consumer is feeling. And he's constantly saying this thing, though it's really unsophisticated, but I get where it's coming from. He's constantly saying there is no one place where people can go to just figure out the facts and understand what's happening in our world anymore. And he's constantly asking people who come on, whether it be someone like Abby Martin or, you know, someone more mainstream, you know, okay, so you're telling me this truth that I don't understand, but where can I go? Where can I just go to get this, like, once? I think he wants this one-stop shop where you can go to get this truth. And I think it's a real struggle for people to reckon with how atomized everything's become. Have you had that sort of experience with others, like people trying to deal with how there isn't one place they can go to understand everything?
Yeah, absolutely. And he's completely right. And that's one of the reasons why his show is popular, because, or, you know, it's right now, just to take the Ukraine story for an example, you know, if you turn on CNN or the New York Times or the Washington Post, you basically know you're getting the anti-Trump take on everything, which may be, you know, factually consistent in most areas, but you want to have somebody who's not interested in the political outcome just kind of run down what the facts are. So, for instance, you know, I wrote about this yesterday. Every single kind of blue state media report on Ukraine contains a disclaimer whenever they mention Hunter Biden or Joe Biden, that there's no evidence of any wrongdoing. and it's like a Surgeon General warning that they stick into the newscast. And the problem with that is that I don't know that that's 100% true. Like, even me as a journalist, I don't know that that's true. I think that there's some indication that, you know, why is the vice president's son getting a $50,000 a month no-show job with a Ukrainian gas company while his dad's vice president? I don't think you can just say that there's nothing there. And yet, you know that if you turn on those news outlets, that's what you're going to get. And I think what people want is what they had more in the past, which is people who really didn't care, or at least professionally didn't care what the political meaning of what they were reporting was, and they sort of chased down all the angles and let you figure it out, and that doesn't really exist anymore, not that much. Yeah,
just like hearing about the actual facts of this is what's going on here and there, and like you kind of put it together, as opposed to like everything being so editorialized. And it really is on every channel. It's kind of like the Fox Newsification of everything for like whatever audience.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Who's
consuming it.
Yeah, no.
But I'm also like curious, like, I don't know if we wanted to move here yet, but I guess we will, because, you know, I work for In the Now, right, which is like in basically like a subsidiary of RT. And I really like working there. It's really great. I get to just like talk shit on camera and kind of say what I want. It's cool. But like something me and Kevin talk about on the show is how like there was a time when I did get to like write for bigger outlets that like weren't state funded. But then the second I opened my mouth about Syria and actually went to Syria, I suddenly became like a taboo person, and I couldn't get work anywhere else. And I got pushed into the only place that will like hire me,
right,
is RT affiliated. Like at this point, that's kind of where I'm at, you know? And so I don't know, is that like a new thing in media where like people ostracize you to the point of like, because, and for Syria, like, yes, I had an opinion, but I also was just being really factual. I'm like, the US is like arming really bad people. Like that was pretty much what I got in trouble for saying. And like that, I just got like deluged with like endless sneers that even leftist outlets were like, sorry, we can't publish you. Like, because everyone hates you so much. So, yeah. Like, is that, like, does that sound like a familiar thing? Like, where people end up, it's kind of crazy. People end up having to turn to adversary state-funded media for work if they want to be in journalism. Because, like, otherwise they can't.
Well,
in America.
Sure. Yeah, no, and you know, that's how propaganda works. You try to create, like, an ick factor around people. And it's not so much that, you know, somebody's coming in, some political commissar is telling you that you can't say this or can't say that, but you do have, there's an unspoken message that if you say X, Y, or Z, that you're going to, again, you're going to be shunned by everybody, and you're going to have, you know, you're going to, it used to be you were going to have to wander the wilds of the alternative weekly business, but since that's been kind of wiped out, now, you know, RT is an example of a place where people can go. And I think if, you know, people complain about RT, but if they didn't want people to watch RT, they would create programming where you could go to be anti-war or against the street, or, you know, right now, it's easy to get a media job if you used to work for the NSA or the or the Pentagon. But if you're an anti-war person, like, good luck. You know what I mean? That's kind of the problem. I think, you know, a lot of the complaints about RT, and I lived in Russia when VOA and RFERL were still big there, and you know, they're not equivalent exactly, but there's. You know, there's some crossover there because the Americans were hiring everybody who was a dissident in Russia, and that's kind of what happens with RT. You know, they're taking advantage of the fact that there are taboos in American media. So, you know, that's a thing now. You're right.
But then they push you to the margins so you can only work at RT, and then they're like, ew, she works for RT.
Exactly. Yeah.
Just, I'm like, well, what, do you want me to starve? I don't understand.
It's sort of like how they complain about Snowden. Oh, look, he's living in Russia. Well, what, do you want him to come back and spend his life
and like die in prison? Yeah. It's insane. It's a fun trick. It's a fun trick they play.
It works though. You know.
Yeah.
You gotta give him that. But yeah, no, it's annoying for sure.
Well, but I do like how you talk about. Oh, sorry, Kevin. Go ahead.
Well, I was gonna say that you spoke to a friend of mine, John Kiriakou, who went through this experience, and he's the CIA whistleblower. People who are listening are probably basically familiar, but you know, he got quoted by Donald Trump, and suddenly, because he was quoted by Donald Trump, you know, not only does that make him an enemy of anyone who follows like the MSNBC or any other of these so-called liberal outlets, but everyone was saying, okay, well, he's not a whistleblower, and he's also a Kremlin propagandist, and maybe
because he has a radio show at Sputnik.
Yeah, he has a radio show at Sputnik. And it's just, you know, it's amazing how some of these things become prioritized so quickly, and the viciousness, the way in which, like, you're able to talk to John, you quoted him for your article, and you didn't really focus on this, but and even Ari Melber actually interviewed John Kiriakou and didn't focus on this at all. Didn't even tell his audience that John has a Sputnik radio show. But like everyone who wanted to discredit, it's like, well,
Ari actually end up airing that segment?
Ari did. So what they did is they cut it was really awful. They just basically diced up Daniel Ellsberg and diced up John Kiriakou and just created these like little sound bites that he could air after he said his own pieces.
God, yeah. Well, I had heard that they kind of spiked a little bit of that broadcast. So, Kiriakou is an example of how, you know, people in the MSNBC world or CNN world, they're like, oh, look at that guy. He goes on Fox News, or that person goes on Tucker Carlson or whatever it is. And well, yeah, I mean, you know, because you're not putting them on your networks and people are nice to them and they're giving them some time. And, you know, I don't. It's frustrating because it's a tail wagging the dog situation. Like you freeze out somebody from having an audience on your side, and then when they go to the other side, you say, "Oh, look, we shouldn't have given that person, you know, airtime because look, you know, who their friends are." And that's not how, you know, it's working backwards, is what I'm saying.
No, it's totally true, especially with the Tucker stuff. Like, it's like, why this idea that you should deny yourself a platform to talk about really important issues? Like Glenn Greenwald goes on Tucker Carlson. Mm-hmm. And talks about like Brazil and how fascist it is, and everyone's like, "Oh my god!" And all they can focus on is Tucker Carlson. But it's like it's the most watched like show in the country, or something like that. I think it's like it's either the most watched or one of the most watched shows in the country. Like, why would you deny? I mean, it's one thing if you're gonna go on and be like refugees are all cancer, but like it's another thing if you're gonna go on and actually like inform people about something really important. Like what the people who watch Fox News. Like, you should also boycott them and never tell them anything smart and let them keep hearing crap all day and only crap. Like, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, no, they've made it completely infamous to go on those shows. And again, with Glenn, the interesting thing with that is that a lot of what he was going on about in the last 2 or 3 years was Russiagate. And I wonder how often Glenn would have gone on Tucker Carlson's show if CNN and MSNBC had given airtime to people who were skeptical about that story. Because I know, right. I think I was the last person who was on MSNBC to talk in a way that was even remotely skeptical about the Russia thing. And I was on in January of 2017, so at the very beginning of this. And you know, they just didn't have anybody who had an alternative viewpoint in that story. And then they complain about, you know, Glenn going on Tucker Carlson's show. Well, let's see what would have happened if you had had more people on your show. You know what I mean? That's the way I look at it.
When you did go on to talk about that, did you feel yourself like tiptoeing around it a little bit because you know that they're all insane and hysterical about Russia?
Well, at the time, that was just at the beginning of all of it, and I didn't even really understand it at the time. I mean, I wasn't covering it, so all I said was, you know, there's two different ways to look at this. You could say that there's a Russian interference story, or you could say there's a Russian interference story that took place with Donald Trump as an accomplice. And I said, you know, the second story is orders of magnitude more serious than the first. And it seems like it should be something that reporters should work out right away, whether the two stories are the same or not, you know? And what they did going forward is they just completely conflated those two issues constantly, because they wanted to, you know, they were so interested in pressing the collusion narrative that you couldn't even pose the question of whether you could have interference without Trump being involved, you know? So, That was frustrating. I mean, again, all I did was ask a couple of questions about it, and that was too much, I thought.
What do you think about the notion that a lot of people in the media just see Russiagate as at least the anti-Russiagate journalism as like conservative media? They see it as like a thing that's just for like the right-wing factions of the U.S. So they don't see it as a left story, that if you're part of the left, to dig in and to disembowel how the establishment has targeted Donald Trump is completely antithetical to what you should be doing.
Yeah, they have a word for it now. They call it anti-Trumpism. you know, they've invented so many words in the last 3 years to describe political deviance. You know, there's both sidesism, there's false equivalencers, there's neo-Naderites, skeptics, and you know, the horseshoe theorists. I mean, there's a, you know, it's like the Soviet Union where they were talking about or Maoist Russia with the micro factionalism or whatever it is. And you know, on the Russia story, for me, I'm no fan of really any kind of politician for the most part, and I'm definitely not a fan of Donald Trump. And what I thought about that story was it was a bad story for the media. Like it just wasn't factually right. I remember when they were saying all this stuff about how he was a foreign agent. And I'm like, well, we can't really say that, you know, just from a reporting point of view, that was bothering me. And it had nothing to do with politics. It was just a job thing. And yet, you know, I immediately got labeled as like a Trump supporter, which was incredibly frustrating for me. You know, I can't we just do the job and worry about that first and not, you know, so yeah, you're absolutely right. And that scares people. You don't want to be labeled as a Trump fan if you're just for worrying about whether or not people think it's factually true. Like that's tough to overcome, you know? So, yeah.
Well, I think it also happened with you over like the impeachment stuff. Cause you wrote about like your, about how like the people basically around Ukraine gate with impeachment are like more dangerous than Trump because of who they are. Like they do represent the deep state. We're not allowed to like talk about it like that anymore because that makes you like a loon to say deep state. Apparently that's not a thing. But no, I mean, it's true. It's like, there's also like, I think that what you were pointing to was something that makes me really uncomfortable with all these stories. It's like, who gains? Who gains from Russiagate? Who gains from like trying to impeach Trump? Like, it's not like we're all gonna gain. It's gonna be these people who were like in charge of the NSA and CIA and are connected to like the military industry and like are propagandizing us. and are really shitty, bad people.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think you presented like a really good argument for that. And I actually remember I tweeted out your piece on that. And like, I just got deluged with people being like, oh, so you support Trump? I was like, that's what you took from this?
I know.
Because like, I support Trump. Because I quoted a few sentences from your piece. It's, yeah. I mean, that's literally the go-to for people.
I know. And it's frustrating because, you know, Donald Trump is, you know, he is what he is. He's the preposterous, you know, in a lot of ways, reprehensible figure. But, you know, it's not like he's completely immune to saying something that's true occasionally. And when he got elected, before he was elected, the heads of the NSA, FBI, CIA, and then the DIA presented him with the Steele report and then, you know, told him they were going to keep it secret and not give the news agencies a quote-unquote news hook to report it. And then they immediately leaked it and did just that. So to me, that's a classic example of something you would see happen in the third world when you know, the security agencies wanted to cripple an executive or push him out. And so, yeah, you know, on some level, yes, Virginia, there is a deep state. That's kind of the point of that. It doesn't mean I like Trump. I just think you have to be real about what's going on here. And then also, I think Russiagate and Ukrainegate also, they're very useful as propaganda tools because it's the same thing. Like it weeds out dissenters because the instant you blanch about it in any way, you get exactly what you described. All those people coming after you and saying, you love Trump, you love Trump. So what happens? You just get in line. You don't say anything. And it's in a very effective way to sort of sterilize the news landscape, and which I think is dangerous in itself.
And I think it's really like, it kind of reminds me of back when Obama was president and, you know, he would be, increasing executive power and like saying he has the right to, you know, the executive has the right to kill people with, you know, on kill lists with drone strikes, including Americans without a trial. And people would be like shouting, like, this is really bad. And like, nobody would care. And it kind of feels like shouting about that same thing in a different way, where it's like, there's kind of a coup, like a security state coup that's been taking place around Trump. And it's so dangerous. And it's like, dude, like one day that could be used against someone you like. Just kind of like the drone thing could be, you know, a power used by someone you don't like one day. I don't know if it makes sense, but.
Absolutely.
But like if Bernie Sanders became president, which I'm like sadly increasingly like not sure whatever happened, but let's say he did, like they could use all of these same tactics against him.
Yeah, that's been my whole point the whole time, is that this is all setting a precedent for things that could be done in the future. Last year, I co-wrote a book with a drug dealer about.
Wait, what?
The business secrets of drug dealing. It's coming out next year, but. But when Michael Cohen's office got raided, my co-author, who's an African American drug dealer, he says, "Man, you know, if they can raid the president's lawyer's office, they can do that to me." You know, and I think this entire years long period of really draconian investigations is creating a precedent where they're going to be able to do that in the future in all different kinds of ways. They're going to violate attorney-client privilege. They're going to use counterintelligence tools in domestic criminal investigations, which they did kind of a lot of in this case, or in the Russiagate case. And there's the whole method of constantly leaking out accusations and having a compliant, unified news media pumping them out 24/7. They're going to be able to do this with any politician. You know, it's not going to be Donald Trump the next time, and we're all going to regret that we didn't stand up and say this is kind of a bad thing, you know, right now. So you're exactly right. Yeah.
Well, I think it's also worth doing a sort of like thought exercise here, and it may make people who are listening uncomfortable because they want anything and everything to get Donald Trump out of office. But Bernie Sanders is a great example for the allegations against him around asking foreign leaders to help give him information on, you know, who may be interviewing him and who might be targeting him and his own government. I mean, it's really odd for me to think that these leaders have any more knowledge than he does in his own government. But this idea of like contacting the Ukrainian leader or talking to the Australian prime minister and saying, you know, do you know any information about what the Bidens have been doing or what Hunter Biden has been doing? Or do you know, or even perhaps, do you know what people have been saying about me? Because I don't like when people talk behind my back and don't like me, which I know Donald Trump is probably having those kinds of conversations with foreign leaders. I mean, what if Bernie Sanders did that? What if Bernie Sanders suspected that like people within these institutions were betraying him and he was using foreign governments to try to find out what was happening? Do I really think progressives would oppose him for doing that? I actually really highly doubt it.
That's right. And it's also a testament to how little control Trump has over his own intelligence agencies, because he can't go to those people for answers. I mean, he's in Australia. What's he doing there? He's trying to get answers for how the Papadopoulos episode came to happen. You know, if you remember, George Papadopoulos in Russiagate was the Trump aide who overheard a conversation with a Maltese professor named Joseph Mifsud, and then repeated it a couple of months later to an Australian diplomat named Alexander Downer. And that's how the Russiagate investigation actually started, the FBI investigation, was because of Downer reported that. And so I think what Trump is trying to find out is who told Downer to have a conversation with George Papadopoulos? Did anybody in your government do that? And so for Trump to do that, it's an extraordinary thing, because it tells you that he can't get those answers in-house. So he's not actually completely running his own security agencies, which is pretty messed up when you think about it. And you're absolutely right. If another president had to resort to that, I don't know if we would begrudge that person, and we would also be seriously freaked out by that situation, I think.
Speaking of Trump, do you think he's going to win again?
Man, I don't know. I mean, I would say no. I would say there'd be no possible way that would let that happen. But I mean, just because he barely made it last time.
Yeah.
But there are reasons to think that he could win again. He, you know, last time when he won, roughly one in five of his voters actively disapproved of him, according to exit polls. They just voted for him because they disliked Hillary more. So, but since then, he's really shored up his support within the Republican Party. I mean, he's about as popular among Republicans as most incumbents are at this stage. So, you know, you never know. And I also think that, you know, impeachment could help him in the end, because a lot of independents aren't sure that it's a good idea. So I would have thought it was impossible, but I think it could happen for sure. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I go back and forth, but there are some days when I'm like, this guy's going to win a second term.
Mm-hmm.
And it's mostly because of the way the other side's acting.
Exactly.
Not even because of him. It's more just the other side is like, it's like Democrats, like, forget what I think about them. They're so bad at being an opposition party.
Yeah,
like, they're so bad at it.
They're the worst. When Trump got elected, and again, I covered Trump's campaign, when Trump got elected, I was convinced that the Democrats would have like a come to Jesus moment, would immediately think, you know, hey, we got to do better, so that people have to think that we're advocating on their behalf more, because so they'll vote for us next time. And what they did exactly the opposite. They spent the next years completely focusing on Donald Trump, which was a strategy that didn't work for Hillary Clinton. Like, she 90% of her ads were negative personal ads about Donald Trump, and that didn't work, you know. And they should have focused more on healthcare and issues that people actually worry about, and that's exactly what they're not doing now. And I don't know.
Yeah, it's like not only what they're not doing, it's like they doubled down on the Hillary Clinton playbook that failed, but like as you know, as part of like the whole Democratic Party just became their go-to. But then also just watching the debates, it's like the majority of the debates are about Trump. And And then, like, you hear, like, from Bernie Sanders mostly, like, sticking to his script, which is so good, you know, of, like, we're going to, like, this is what's wrong with the country. This is what we're going to do for working people. But then it's like, I just don't see any way that he's going to be the, I feel like he's not going to, maybe I'm just a pessimist, but I feel like there's no way he's going to be the nominee. Yeah, I'd love for him to, but, like, I just don't see how it's possible. But I also just like to keep myself disappointed so I won't be disappointed, if that makes sense. But then also, like, I'm looking at who else there is, and it's like Joe Biden, like, he could probably beat Trump, but there's a chance he might not. And then I just don't think Elizabeth Warren could. I don't know why, but I just don't feel like she could. And that's stupid. It's not based on statistics. It's just a feeling. So, like, it doesn't, it's like there's no evidence behind it. But well, it's more just like a feeling that she just can't. She can definitely activate the Democratic base, but I don't think she can do more than that.
Yeah, Elizabeth Warren, a friend of mine who works for one of the campaigns, said Elizabeth Warren is identity politics for journalists because she's basically us. She's me. She's an intellectual from Massachusetts, and so we all identify with her because she's kind of from the same world that we are. But that's not who most voters, identify with. That's why that's why there's a significant amount of working class support that goes to Joe Biden and also to Bernie before they'll go to Elizabeth, because they see, you know, Biden is, I think, a phony on a lot of levels, but he at least has that background. Where Warren doesn't, and so it's a classic example of a candidate that reporters think is perfect, and voters don't, and that happened. We saw that with Dukakis and some other, Al Gore is another one of these sort of smart people who doesn't connect with ordinary voters as well, and I don't know. I mean. Maybe it'll work, maybe not. I just don't know.
Well, I can just see a scenario where if, let's say, I don't even know how Warren would be the nominee, because black voters don't seem to be going for her they would for someone like Joe Biden. But let's say she's the nominee. I can just imagine it would be just Donald Trump calling her Pocahontas the whole time.
Oh, yeah.
And people thinking it's funny because she's got a plan for everything or whatever. And she tries to do this really folksy thing, but she's not really folksy. She's my daddy raised me in Oklahoma. And she just tries to do this persona that doesn't seem authentic. And so I don't know. I just don't know how that will work. And she kind of probably represents something that I was going to sound messed up, but I feel like would repulse a lot of people just based on her persona, just based on the way she presents herself, who are in middle America, who'd be ew, not her. She's just this woman who is really smart. We don't want a woman who's smarter than us to be president. I don't know.
Well, no, I mean, look, there's something to that. I hate to admit it, but I think there is something to that. But I think there's also, that certainly didn't help Hillary Clinton. I mean, that's not a reason not to vote for her, but that was.
No, but I'm just talking about voters. Yeah.
And with the Pocahontas thing, they're going to do that over and over again, mainly because Elizabeth Warren hasn't owned that problem yet.
The way she responds to it is so bad.
It's so bad. She's had so long to think about it, and she still keeps stepping over and over again into the same trap and doubling down, and that doesn't work. Donald Trump is he's like a football coach that will keep running the same play over and over again until the other team changes their tactics. And he has no compunction about repeating something 5,000 times in a month, until it goes away. And that's what's going to happen with her. They're going to hammer her on that one until something breaks there, I think.
That, and they'll be I could see them being she was a Republican until she wasn't. What a phony, And she hasn't, and I remember seeing her try to respond to that once, and it was such a bad response because she wasn't prepared. It's like, how have you not thought about how you would answer that? You're going to get asked it.
Yeah. And she has a little bit of a defensive thing, but that's human. But Trump is, I think it'll be interesting to see, because Elizabeth Warren, I do think that she's smart enough to at least think about how to approach verbally engaging Donald Trump in a way that wouldn't be completely self-destructive. Whereas I think Joe Biden would be lost, right? In a
Joe Biden would just be like tripping over his words, right, talking about that time at the pool.
Yeah. And Trump would be like every cafeteria bully you ever knew in high school, who will just, you know, shamelessly pick on him for it. Elizabeth wouldn't fall for that, but you know, she, as you say, she's got some other issues that he will definitely exploit.
I know Kevin wanted to ask a question about non-voters.
Well, sure. Well, the thing about non-voters was really a fascinating thing to me, just because you're right that, like, there's this whole genre. So connected to it, one thing I have a lot of experience with is this genre out there of vote shaming, of really going after people for not voting, but also for not voting for particular candidates. That's a relatively new thing in the last 10 or 20 years, right?
Yeah. And first of all, non-voters historically don't appear very much in news coverage, which, because part of what you're getting when you watch campaign journalism, and it's just a reality show. It's not really about politics. It's a money-making enterprise where they sell it very much like sports. You know, they build up the suspense there, and non-voters they suspend disbelief. If you put them on air and that you show a bunch of people who don't like either candidate and don't feel motivated that voting is actually going to change their lives in any meaningful way, then it ruins the show, because it hurts the whole premise of the reporting, this idea that this is this massively important thing. If you have 50 million people in the country who don't believe that, then what you're actually reporting on is this creeping despair hovering over the country and dysfunctionality, and that's a very different kind of story. So they've really excised people who don't participate in the process from coverage. But yeah, you're right. You know, they've targeted people for supporting this or that candidate more often than they did in the past. Like, you'll see a lot of these stories sort of making fun of Republican voters, and, you know, I get that. But I don't love that genre either.
I mean, is there anything worse that the media can do to ruin people's faith and interest in watching them than to publish pieces like what the Atlantic or the New York Times does on, like, the people who support Tulsi Gabbard? To, like, I feel like there was a thing that Edward Isaac DeVere did where he was, like, talking about them as, like, they're hippies and they like their dream catchers, and then there's cryptocurrency enthusiasts, and then there's just anti-imperialists, and those are just the people who would support Tulsi, nobody else.
Right, and then there's the Bernie phenomenon, the Bernie bros are sexist and racist and all that, and
girls are just there for the boys.
Oh my God,
what I support. I support Bernie Sanders because I'm looking for boys.
Well, or he reminds you of your grandpa.
Oh, that's creepy. Do I have a crush on my grandpa?
You might.
I might. This is why I need some introspection for why, as a woman, I support this man.
You need to keep it real with yourself. Yeah.
There's something deranged, like, fetish problems I have in my brain. But no, but it's really – the other thing, too, is, like, the way that they go after third-party voters.
Yeah.
Like, how – and I know there's actually one girl who she used to write for The Intercept. Now she's on the Bernie campaign, Brianna Joy Gray. Oh. Am I saying her name right?
Yeah.
She, like – I think she voted for, like, Jill Stein, but she's in New York. And, right, like, when she first started the Bernie campaign, she got attacked. Like, all these people tried to make a thing of it. And it's like, she lives in New York. Like, right, she didn't win Trump the election. But also, who cares? It's none of your business who somebody votes for. Like, there's nothing more gross than actually, like, vote shaming people. And, like, I can't imagine, yeah, that would get anybody engaged in any sort of process of, like, wanting to participate if they aren't already, is seeing people vote shamed.
Yeah, and I don't know what their thought process is when they do that. I mean, I'm not terribly political myself, but you know, I liked Bernie Sanders. I've known him for a long time, but when I started to get lots and lots of people on social media and even other editorial writers, you know, saying, basically accusing me of being racist because I like Bernie Sanders.
Wait, what?
Yeah, no, I mean, the whole Bernie Burrow thing,
because you didn't like the black, because you weren't nicer to the black woman, Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, exactly. that suddenly makes me more engaged in politics. That makes me upset, you know, as opposed to just disinterested. And so I don't know what they're doing when they say, oh, if you're a green, you're like an enemy of the people, or if you're, you know, a Tulsi Gabbard voter. And a lot of Tulsi Gabbard's voters are just people who have, I would say, more middle of the road social politics. Or they're anti-war, you know, in a certain way, and they like what she says about that. I mean, you really want to tell those people that they're Russian agents? I don't know how that helps the cause in the end, except to make the one thing that it does achieve is that you get a more monolithic media landscape, because people are going to be afraid to say anything in favor of those folks.
Sorry for the beeping.
We enjoy the sound effects. It amplified what Matt was saying.
Yeah, it's like they were beeping in support of what you were saying, Matt.
Exactly. Yeah. I'll get to agree with Matt. That's the
Lebanese drivers during rush hour. But I think also with the way that, you know, with the way that they try to put voters in boxes as well, like, and also sort of the route that the Democratic Party has taken to really double down on identity politics, like, to the point of it's just so extreme that, like, I don't think most average people can connect with some of the red meat, if you will, that Democrats throw at, like, their base when it comes to, like, Elizabeth Warren in her Twitter profile has she, her. Have you ever noticed that?
Yeah.
It's like in her Twitter bio, I'm like, first of all, like, nobody thought that maybe you were trans that you needed to, like, identify your pronoun. Second of all, like, I don't know who you're trying to reach with, like, that sort of, like, it's just this sort of, like, trying to, like, check off these boxes for your base when at the end of the day, like, I don't know how much of the country that actually works on.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I have a theory about that. I think what happened in 2016, when the Democratic Party realized that it had obviously a serious problem on its hands, because there was this huge schism in the party where they were clearly losing a huge portion of their, what you might call the progressive left, right? There were people who were jumping on the Sanders bandwagon. And I think, you know, because the party couldn't go the other direction and become, reject corporate influence, right? Like, that would have been the logical way to deal with the Sanders phenomenon, is just to sort of stop dividing your loyalties between big corporate donors and voters. That's what Sanders was really trying to do. Well, since they couldn't do that, what they decided to do to sound more progressive, I thought, was just become more sort of superficially progressive and adopt a lot of the language of intersectionality and campus liberalism and that sort of stuff, because that didn't have any real effect on the money aspect of their business. And I get, and it also had the benefit of, you know, that particular brand of politics is very useful in kind of disciplining the ranks, right? Because if you fall out of line, it's very easy to get to use it as a tool to get people back. I mean, they used a lot of the language of intersectionality to go after Bernie Sanders. I don't know. I think it was self-destructive in the end. But it's hard to say. Yeah.
Now they're all just like, every candidate's going to come out as gay eventually. That's like the only way they can prove their bona fides is to just be like either like a lesbian or a gay person. Like Elizabeth, no, I'm seriously, like at this point, like it's become like, you know, you've got Amy, or I don't know if she did it actually, but it was Kirsten Gillibrand was just like made these videos at Gay Pride, like, to try and, you know, really show the base that she's super progressive. It's like that's become the symbol of like the sort of cheapest way to say that I'm with you is just like these markers that don't actually mean anything at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to show that you believe in gay rights and
for sure.
Yeah,
But, no, I'm not saying the opposite. I'm not like, screw that. No, it's not like, it's more just like, it's like desperate overkill.
Right, right, right. And yeah, it's hard to know how that's going to go over with you know, sort of independent crossover voters. But, I mean, part of the legend of the party is now that we just don't need those voters anymore. So, which you know, I don't know how that works exactly, but yeah, it's a tricky issue. But I think you're right. There is something there that needs to be explored for sure.
Well, when you were like, so you did this piece at a Trump rally, mm-hmm. which I thought was really interesting. Especially because of the way you ended it, where you were like outside and you saw these protesters and then the reaction from the Trump people. Can you kind of like lay that out? Because I thought it was a really interesting episode.
Yeah. So I got out there at the stadium. I forget what it was called, in Cincinnati, where Trump was having a rally. And, outside the stadium, there were two groups of people who were yelling at each other. There were all the Trump fans who were, first of all, extraordinarily numerous. I mean, they had like 22,000 people there. They had to turn away 3,000 or 4,000 people at the gates. And on the other side, there were a bunch of sort of lefty activists who I recognized because I grew up in that world, you know. And, you know, there was a guy who sort of had the Che Guevara beard and the megaphone talking about, you know, yelling out Marxist slogans, and he yells out at the Trump people, like Trump, something like Trump betrayed the working class, and the people yelled back, "We are the working class, buddy," or something like that. And the thing about that was striking is that it's true. There's no way to avoid the class thing when you look at Trump, and it really drove me nuts after Trump got elected, when they tried to prove to you with numbers that wasn't true, that it was somehow more affluent people who were voting for Trump. That may be true statistically because you're getting the very, very poorest people voting for Democrats often, but so it rounds out that there are more affluent people voting for Trump. But there's certainly a huge class situation going on with the Trump thing, whereas, you know, it's definitely sort of ex-working class people who are voting for him. And, but, you know, that's a clear dynamic that it is actually true. And, but you won't see that written about much, because the legend is that it's some other kind of movement.
I just have a couple quick things and then we'll wrap and let you go. It's been really great to have this conversation. One thing that's sort of diverging from where we've been going with this conversation, I've done a lot of work covering Chelsea Manning and also WikiLeaks, and I was just curious what your viewpoint is on how all this fits into what's been happening with the media landscape. And I've been really struck in the last week or two, I'm not sure how much you've been able to follow any of this, but I've been struck in the last week or two by how, and I know the biases of the media. I know everything that from working that how ignorant they want to be and how they're not going to pay attention and the omissions and distortions. And yet, you know, we had this huge story from Spain about how the CIA was actually spying on the people who were visiting Julian Assange in the Ecuador embassy. And
right.
They were sending these files, this amateurish sort of like Stratfor-like private security company in Spain was sending back this material to the CIA to access, and targeted Ellen Nakashima at the Washington Post. And it really incredibly, like, Ellen was trying to leave, and she, this guy wrote down in this report that he was trying to steal her phone battery, but that Ellen Nakashima got to the door of the embassy and realized that she didn't have it, and so came back and got it, so he wasn't able to steal her phone battery, which I thought was kind of incredible. But nobody in the press even said anything. It's not really even poking out of Spain. And when I complained about it on Twitter, you get people from like Germany and other countries who say, no, it's not making it to our countries either. Our media also is ignoring it as well. So I just, you know, that's a very specific thing, but I'm sort of curious how you feel about the whole general case that's been brought against Julian Assange, and how at this moment he's in this maximum security prison about to be put on trial for an Espionage Act violation, you know, and amidst all of what we've talked about with Russiagate and what you've talked about. And he's sort of this figure where, like, he shifted. If you go back to 2010, he was this guy that was a darling of progressives who was reporting all this information about the Bush administration that we thought was important about wars. And then now he's a darling kind of. He was a darling for a little bit of the right-wing media, but now it's almost like nobody really knows what to do with him.
Yeah, and in the story you tell about, you know, Ellen Nakashima, and it's connected, because what has driven me crazy about the Assange phenomenon is the total lack of institutional pride that journalists have had in dealing with the story. People should be upset. They should be furious at the mere suggestion that the security agencies are improperly surveilling the press. You know, we should all band together and be pissed off about that. And the Assange case is a shot directly at the news media, because, you know, he's not being charged with anything related to 2016. He's being charged with essentially for doing something that basically everybody who has ever worked with a national security source has done. You know, you've provided logistical support for those people. You've counseled them on whether or not to come to go forward. And that's the second round of charges against Assange are essentially all about handling national security or national defense information and helping it become public, which is something that journalists have been doing since the beginning of time. So if he gets convicted on this, anybody who does any kind of national security reporting that the government doesn't like is going to be looking at, you know, not like a fine, but like real jail time for like long periods of time. And we should be terrified about that and kind of banding together and saying that's horrible. And yet, because Assange has been successfully painted as a, you know, a Russian proxy who helped Donald Trump get elected, nobody will touch it, and they won't defend him. So that's, I think, this whole episode has really freaked me out. I mean, I don't know how I feel about Julian Assange personally, but I know how I feel about his case. And I think there people should be brave enough to make that distinction. And look, personally, Julian Assange has broken more stories than basically any news reporter, you know, all the best investigative reporters in the country combined. I mean, you know, he's put out stuff about America, about North Africa, about Egypt. I mean, you know, so this whole thing is an important episode in the history of American reporting, and it's been very frustrating to watch.
Yeah, it's really grotesque, because what you see is like cheerleading for this guy's death, like right. in some cases, like it's shocking. And I don't know why, you know, it's been a really useful too, because he's this like, you know, he's like this odd character who has like a strange personality and isn't all that likable. And so they've managed to do a really good job making it about his personality rather than like about the bigger picture. Like, it's like, who cares even if he has like the worst personality in the world and he's an asshole, like who cares?
Right. It's like... he's Emmanuel Goldstein. That's what they've done with him. Mm-hmm. He's the evil guy in exile. Yeah.
And it's just like they, although to be fair, like, I don't know, I could be wrong, but as far as national security reporters go, Kevin, you would know this better because you follow this stuff more closely, but do national security reporters seem sympathetic towards him?
Oh, absolutely not.
Or do they
not.
Have the same sort of, oh, really? Like, even national security reporters? I mean on TV, I mean, like, in writing. Like,
no.
There have been a few, I mean, like, the Committee to Protect Journalists has come out about this, and they've been pretty good about it. And you haven't seen the people who would be most directly affected by this come out and worry about it. and the reason for that is there aren't that many people who do aerial national security reporting. So there are people who handle national defense information, but they're usually doing it in a way that's sort of in sync with national security objectives. So there aren't that many Cy Hirsches out there anymore who are digging up, you know, stories about atrocities or anything like that. So that's why you're not hearing that kind of thing.
Yeah, I guess if like I was a national security beat reporter, like the Washington Post, and all my reporting is just like this anonymous official told me to say this, I probably wouldn't care about Julian Assange either.
Yeah, you're David Ignatius, and you've got your sources at the CIA, then you don't really have to worry about talking to other people. It's not a big deal if the government's going to target you, because there's nobody you're trying to protect. Your sources are people who are supported by the government, and that's where you're going to get your information, right? Like, there's no...
He's a house cat for the CIA, right? He's not gonna be upset about this. So that's a job. I mean, you know, it's a legitimate thing. I get it, but it's again, it's not like Cy Hirsch, who is a person who's gonna be telling stories about, you know, the military, you know, putting people in mass graves and that sort of thing. Like that's not what you're getting.
So
yeah,
so the last thing
isn't anyone like that
I have for you, and we'll wrap is. This whole thing that happened at the end of the Democratic debate on October 15th, where the final question was about being friends with Ellen DeGeneres and George W. Bush, and how they should be able to have their friendship, and it's wrong for us to be mean to people who are implicated in atrocities that were committed in Iraq. And by the way, the only person who was a candidate that engaged in the bullshit premise of that question was Julian Castro, to his credit.
Right.
I listened to the responses in this whole question. I couldn't help but think of your book, because you write a bunch in here about how we're told to hate each other, and yet we consistently find in the media, on the media establishment's own terms, them begging us to get along with each other and engage in bipartisanship and reach across the aisle. And all of these, you know, I guess idioms or phrases that they like to trot out to make us no longer feel like something that happened was wrong and deserves accountability.
Right. Well, the aisle isn't really the same aisle anymore, though. I mean, I think what they're trying to do is reestablish that people who, like Mitt Romney and George H.W. Bush, these people are, you know, all part of the sort of general big power structure. And so it's perfectly appropriate for celebrities and Democrats to have good relationships with, you know, John McCain, George W. Bush. And so you're encouraged to kind of think of those people as legitimate people. It's Trump is on the other side of the aisle right now. It would be unusual to see them saying, why don't we all get along with, you know, Rudy Giuliani or Trump. This whole idea of we shouldn't get upset about people who want to be friends with George Bush, just because that whole trope of, you know, the Democrat and the Republican, or the rich Republican and the rich Democrat who get together, and it's like the cute animal friendships trope on the internet. Like that's CNN and the press always loves those stories. And I don't know that you're right. That whole question was kind of nauseating, even if it doesn't mean a whole lot, but it was gross to watch for sure. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Matt.
Matt, that was awesome. Thank you for giving us your time. It's like so great to finally get you on. We've been actually, it's my fault, because I asked you months ago if you'd come on, and then Kevin kept being like, did he answer? And I was like, no. And then I went back and looked, and you actually had answered, and I'm just a huge idiot.
That's all right. There's so many things you got to keep track of now with letters, so it's hard to know.
Also, there's like a thousand different social media applications with messages to keep track of. It's really
exactly.
annoying.
Yeah, did you message him on Skype? Did you message him on Facebook?
Right?
How did we get at you? We don't really remember.
Yeah,
so. It was so great getting to talk to you.
We'll have to come on our show sometime.
And
if you're not listening, I do have to highly recommend the Useful Idiots podcast. It's mm-hmm. now my ritual.
It's fun. I like actually watching it. It's like one of the few podcasts. It's really fun to actually watch.
Every lunch on Friday is now Useful Idiots time for me.
Excellent. Yeah, we'll have to have you on. Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks,
Rania.
Patrons of the Unauthorized Disclosure Weekly podcast were able to get early access to the interview with Matt Taibbi. If you'd like to get early access to future interviews recorded for this podcast, go to patreon.com/unauthorizeddisclosure. Not only do we offer early access, but frequently we're posting exclusive bonus content. The guests we typically are having on this show are individuals who are not offered platforms in the establishment media. They are formally or informally blacklisted in some cases. You won't see them on MSNBC. You won't see them on CNN. Whether it's the Trump administration or Clinton Democrats who suppress dissent by baselessly smearing individuals as agents of a foreign power, the success of our guests is usually dependent on their ability to gain recognition in spite of this toxic politics. So please consider supporting our show by going to patreon.com/unauthorizeddisclosure and become a patron today. We'll be back next week with another episode.